We're at the Santa Fe Institute at a workshop on systems biology and the physical foundations of aging with Aviv Bergman, who's a biologist at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University in New York. And you just started a new department, so you're professor and chair of systems and computational biology at Einstein, which seems very appropriate for this meeting. When the meeting began, the workshop began, and people were going around the table trying to get some definitions out there and trying to explain what they thought they meant by systems biology or where we were going to go with aging, you actually said, "We do not know what aging is." And you said that you hoped that systems biology would lead possibly to a new language, a new vocabulary, a new way of talking about biological processes. Now, I know you don't mean that you don't know what. You see people get gray hair and so on. But to actually define aging in a precise way, there was still a lot of back and forth around the table. I mean, did anything come out of this? Do you have a better sense now of well?
Better sense of what comes out of it, not really. What came out of this meeting, I believe, is going to be very influential in terms of where the funding by the NIH is going to be allocated. And not, now, there were not new paradigms that came out of this meeting in terms of the definition of aging. Most people are still talking about aging as a process by which you accumulate mutations, you accumulate degradation, damage, etc. On one hand, on the other hand, you have other people who are interested in the metabolic pathways of aging, like caloric restriction and so on and so forth. So there were practically very much the same school of thoughts that we came to the meeting, we ended up with. There was one interesting element that was added to that, and I think this is where a lot of attention should be placed, and this is developing a more physical theory for understanding aging. I come from an evolutionary biology background, and one of the things that evolutionary biologists think about is the role of natural selection in all of that process, in aging included as a biological process. and most biologists, evolutionary biologists, and every individuals practically, the lay people equate evolution with progress and assign enormous amount of importance to the optimization of X, Y, or Z. however, and I will relate that to aging in a minute. However, evolution is not something which is operating in vacuum. We are working with now. We are operating within the context of the physical world. We have physical constraints, we have biophysical constraint, we have chemical constraint, biochemical constraint, we have even biomechanical constraints when we think about the way or the environment by which organisms are developing and evolving. And if we look at the influence of those constraints on the evolution of X, Y, or Z trait. Sometimes those constraints play by far more significant role in shaping what it is that we end up with rather than simply the forces of natural selection. So the constraints that the physical world impose upon an organism may dictate a lot of what we might attribute to natural selection. And I think that aging might fall into this category of an unavoidable outcome rather than a selected for when we talk about the evolution of aging. Some people attributed some selection quality, some selection advantage for death or for senescence. But on the other hand, it might be something which is completely unavoidable. And this is something that might come out of this workshop as addressable.
But one of the things that was interesting was that you could see a curve that showed that in humans anyway, over the last century, last 200 years, lifespan for a great many people had increased dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, there seemed to be nobody has lived over 122 and a half years. But if you ask any of the people who are in the room, if there is programmed death, if we're programmed to die, they will say, not really. And these seem to be conflicting viewpoints. I mean, could you help me resolve that?
This is what I was saying about the physical constraints. We as an organisms are what we call systems far from equilibrium. We take in energy and we dissipate this energy. And by doing so, there are certain processes such as accumulation of mutations or accumulation of or increase in this in the disorder of the systems that makes us tick that are accumulated regardless of whether or not we will have mechanism that will protect us against those damages. So in principle, indeed, we might have the capacity to do a repair mechanism, but the repair mechanism themselves might be degraded, so it will be kind of a negative feedback loop that at the end of which the repair mechanism themselves will not be able to, will no longer be able to repair what has been damaged by the external factors. So, and Jeffrey West, for example, is coming up with an interesting theory that is based solely on first principle from thermodynamics and physical argument that, in a sense, how shall I say it, dictate what might be the maximum lifespan of an organism, regardless of the fact that we might at some point have a repair mechanism. But as I said, those repair mechanisms themselves are subject to the same degradations. So, as I said, I think that looking at biology and evolution and what's possible and what's not possible without taking into account those the environment by which we are living in, and I'm not talking about the physical environment, I'm talking about the physics of the environment, is not misleading, but it is neglecting an important element that at point may be the major factor that dictates those properties. And this comes from some of our work on the evolution of robustness, for example.
Robustness is a concept I'd like you to explain, but let me just sort of ask, let me bring this, this is probably a bad analogy, but it's not so long ago that Lemaître wrote a book called Man a Machine, basically. So there's a mechanistic view of life in which we could look at ourselves as being moving parts, mm-hmm. right? And when things wear out, you fix them. So this is the car analogy, I suppose. The tires are worn out, so we'll get another one. The hip joint's worn out, we'll get another one of those things. So you can repair, you can do spare part surgery and so on and so forth, which presumably prolongs life and so on. That's one of the reasons why we're living longer.
Mm-hmm.
But systemically, in terms of cellular prolongation of life, what I was saying was that some people are saying that there's no theoretical reason why life should stop. I mean, there's no programmed death in there. But so if it's a series of degradations, if it's a series of accumulations of deleterious effects and so on, is the engineering that Tuck Finch originally suggested, that Aubrey de Grey now is evangelizing in a sense, of repairing a series of steps that lead to senescence. Mm-hmm. Is that a possible direction to go? And would that prolong life to the extent that he's even suggesting?
Just to be provocative, you're changing the definition of life in this case. Now, if we were to look at only the living cells without the machinery that might enable us to prolong life, then the definition of the living cell is being, in some sense, washed away. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting concept, and it is a possibility. As I was telling you in the corridor, elephants die from starvation. They do not die from old age. They die because their teeth are worn out and fall off. And at that point, even though physically they are capable of prolonging life, of much more prolonged life, because they do not have the machinery, they will be they starve to death. So if we were to have an elephant dentist, so to speak, will it be the same elephant? So if we were to extend our life by using the machines and using other external input to the system, sure, we can extend life, but I'm not sure that we will be able to extend life indefinitely unless we end up replacing every part of it. But I think that when we talk about human longevity and mammalian longevity and some other model organism longevity like Drosophila or C. elegans, etc., to some extent we are barking on the wrong tree in terms of trying to understand the process of aging. And recently I'm started to be interested in Hymenoptera, social insects, where over there we see an enormous lifespan discrepancy between the worker wasp or worker bee and the drones and the queen. And just to be on the provocative side, over there you have the same genome that on one hand lives 3 weeks while the queen is living 30 years. So it is as if I'm sitting here talking to King David, more to the point, to talking to Queen Bathsheba, furthermore, fertile Queen Bathsheba, laying 2,000 eggs per day throughout her lifespan. So if we want to understand how to extend lifespan, not twofold, threefold, or tenfold, namely 300-fold, we might want to go and look at Hymenoptera. And over there, it comes from the same genome. And it is all kind of an epigenetic process. So it sounds kind of an astonishing, but it is not really, because if we look at our body, we have skin cells that live for few weeks or sometimes days or so on one hand. On the other hand, the same genome, we have neurons that lives forever, relatively. So here are two set of cells that on one hand, one cell type is living very, very short, the other is living extremely long relative to our skin cell. And we haven't studied what might be the epigenetic phenomena differences between those two cell types. So I think that we still might have some hope, but I don't want to, or maybe one want to, convert all of their cell types into neuronal type. We might live forever, but at the end of the day, I think As I said earlier, we will not be able to look at life as we know it today if we were to replace everything with either machine or other genetically differentiated cells.
I just want to follow up that point for a minute because it's sort of interesting in the sense that you could easily make an analogy, a perfectly strong one, between the foraging of honeybees and people making a living. In the sense that what the bee is doing is using a system with, in this case, VUMMX1, a neuron, which is a reward system, which in this case is octopamine as opposed to dopamine, but it's essentially the same thing. It's an animal looking for a reward, noting where the reward is, keeping information about where the reward is, and building, therefore, a kind of a network of information which allows it to go back to the same place and so on and so forth. Human beings do the same sort of thing. I mean, they're essentially using the same neural networks and reward systems. So your story there about the social insects Hymenoptera and the enormous generational difference between workers and queen, for example, is it possible to even conceive of finding out what is actually going on there and implementing that kind of a system in humans?
This is a project that we are currently proposing to work on, to study the genetic, or more to the point, the epigenetical differences that are operating between the workers and the drones and the queen. And one might say, okay, the workers might go out to forage, etc. They are exposed to much more harmful environment. But even if you were to take the worker and to put it in a sheltered environment, you can extend their lifespan, you know, a week or two, but you can never expand that to a 300-fold or 100-fold to reach the level of the queen. But indeed, this is the topic of one of our interests, and this is why I said if we were to look at mammals or humans in order to study longevity, we might not barking on the wrong tree, but there are other models or model living systems that may give us much more interesting hints and shed more interesting light into the understanding the process of aging or understanding the process of longevity.
I'm not sure which job I would like to choose anyway, being a worker or a queen. It sounds like a fairly depressing business sitting there for thousands of generations. What did you mean by, is this a term of art, this term robustness? I mean, what does it mean in this context?
Robustness in terms, in biological terms, means insensitivity to perturbation. Perturbations might be in the form of mutations, might be in the form of environmental assaults, or might be in form of environmental variation. You and I differ dramatically at our genetic basis. There is at least 6 per 1,000 base pair, which is different between you and I. But nevertheless, we share enormous amount of common traits, like 2 eyes, 5 fingers, etc. Indeed, there are 6-fingered people in the population, but the frequency by which you observe six-fingered people in the population is by far less than one would expect, given the underlying genetic variation that is present. So the robustness is the insensitivity to mutation, so all of this underlying genetic variation is not percolated to the phenotypic level. It is at the phenotypic level we share enormous amount of commonality. And this is an old idea. It comes from Waddington, and Waddington was one of the early proponents of this idea. He termed it canalization rather than robustness, but robustness is practically a modern term for what Waddington was terming canalization. We are canalized to one of few possible outcomes, and if we perturbed, the perturbation eventually during developmental process tunnel us back to the one of a few possible viable outcomes. So this is what I mean by robustness.
Canalization, another bit, channeled into.
Channeling into a particular outcome.
Yeah, right. So, in terms of specifically your new center and systems approaches, I mean, how does that change the game for trying to understand these processes?
It's an interesting question as to what is the role of biologists, what is the role of physician scientists, what is the role of theoreticians in this game. There is no distinction anymore, I think, when we are trying to address questions that relate to human health or to human well-being. We can no longer address these issues one gene at a time or even one pathway at a time. We need to look at the system as a whole. And the best diagnostician practically are what I would call systems biologists, because they look at the system as a whole and they end up with a diagnostic which is not taking into account only one or the other element. And in the department that we have just created at Albert Einstein, what we are trying to address is to see how more theoretically oriented and inclined people, theoretically and computationally inclined people, can provide to the way people think about the particular biological problems that they are addressing. So I can talk about aging, we can talk about cancer, we can also talk about the immune system. And there are many other examples of that nature, diabetes and so on and so forth. What we are trying to bring into the arena is a set of not only tools, but more to the point, a way of thinking about the problem which is not looking at it from a reductionist point of view. People who work in aging can look at CO2, can look at IGF pathway, and can look at this or the other protein that may be correlated with aging or that may be correlated with deleterious outcome. And one can go and study the biology of that particular element. However, let me give you an example from cancer. You and I may possess a deleterious variant of P53. A variant that causes the development of many varieties of cancers. However, because you and I differ genetically, the flip side of robustness is the capacity to accumulate variation at the genetic background. So even if you and I possess exactly the same mutant of P53, because of your genetic background, you will not develop the phenotype, you will not develop the cancer, while I will develop the cancer. So if I were to look at the effect of P53, or the deleterious variant of P53, and monitor only the fact that you and I possess the P53 deleterious variant, harmful variant, then one will say, okay, you and I have the same capacity or the same prognosis to develop the cancer. We as systems biology do not take only that into account, but try to take a bigger picture and see what it is that the rest of the genotype, what it is that the rest of the genetic background can provide you in terms of the prognosis. So for example, we are working on the head and neck cancer. And for the same, if the pathologist come to me and say, you and I have exactly the same cancer. However, because of our genetic differences, the prognosis that you will have is going to be by far better than the prognosis that I have. Mm-hmm. So if I were to be able to predict what the prognosis is going to be on the basis of the rest of the genotype, then you will not need to go through an aggressive treatment. I will need to go through an aggressive treatment. Aggressive treatment might kill you, will not help you. But if I were to understand the rest of the genetic background, how it affects the progression of the cancer, the severity of the cancer, and so on and so forth, then we will be able to design a much better treatment for that, for your type of cancer.
And we're not there yet? We're not at that point?
We are very far from that point. We are only at the tip of the iceberg. Luckily, technology is such that we are moving quite faster in this direction, and eventually people are talking about model organism. Eventually, I believe that human will become the model organism. We will not do experiments on humans. However, the technology will provide us with sufficient data to be accumulated across many, many, many individuals, and by isophenotyping, so to speak, the different individuals, it will be as if we have done the experiment. Nature have done the experiment for us by accumulating the mutation, and I will be able to isolate different group and study their genetic as if we were model organisms, but we are far from being there.
So I was looking at this paper that you wrote with McCarthy, the coevolution of robustness, epistasis, and recombination favors asexual reproduction. What does that mean?
Oh, this is it's an interesting observation that we were trying to rebuttal a claim that a previous model that we have developed also explain the paradox of the evolution of sexual reproduction, which is the paradox of twofold cost for sexual reproduction. And the twofold cost for sexual reproduction goes something like that. If an organism were to reproduce asexually in one reproduction process, that entity transmit to the next generation its entire genome. However, if you were to reproduce sexually, you transmit only half of your genome to the next generation. So in order to cover the entire genome, you need to have, on average, two individuals that cover your entire genome. So here you have a twofold cost for sexual reproduction. And there are many, many theories that describe or try to explain why it is that we reproduce sexually. But the fact of the matter is that most of the biomass in the world does not reproduce sexually. It reproduces asexually. So we have developed this model for the evolution of robustness. And one of the things that we have demonstrated in this model is that there may not be a need for selection or for an advantage for robustness in order for that robustness to evolve. We will not go into the explanation of why this is the case, but this is one of those elements that I was talking about earlier. This is kind of an unavoidable outcome of the genotype-phenotype mapping. If there is a genotype-phenotype mapping which is complex, as a side effect, you end up with a robust system, insensitive system to mutation. Along the process of evolution that we were experimenting with, and this is an in silico evolution, what one could observe is that our system is such that when you introduce a mutation to the system, there is a reduction of, let's say, some epsilon, or there is reduction in the fitness of that entity that we were toying with. If you introduce the second mutation, it is reduced by, let's say, yet another epsilon. One of the outcomes of the experiment that we were doing with and without sexual reproduction is that when you introduce those two mutations into a sexually reproducing individual versus an asexually reproducing individual, in the asexual reproduction, you have a slightly less reduction in fitness when you introduce those two mutations, while in the sexually reproducing population, when you introduce this double mutant, the fitness was reduced by far larger. There was a larger deleterious effect of those two mutations. And this comes from, and the argument of, or the, this observation is called synergetic epistasis in evolutionary biology terms. And it was developed or proposed by Kondrashov. And the idea that this is indeed something that helped the evolution of sex is that if indeed the accumulation of those two mutations reduces the fitness much more than the expected average of each one of them separately, this reduction will weed away the population from those deleterious effects. And since sexual reproduction brings together two mutations that occur in different individuals more quickly than the production of those mutations independently, one after the other, it will take much longer time to generate, then the sexual reproduction system, sexual reproduction population will be what's called purified from those deleterious mutations. The argument that we were looking at the paper was to address what happened if you were to mix now those two populations or those two types of individuals, those who can reproduce sexually versus those who can reproduce asexually together. And we have demonstrated that indeed, if you were to separate them on completely two different populations and you let them evolve independently, indeed, the asexual ones are evolving robustness much less than the sexual ones. However, and the fitness reduction in the asexual ones is less than that from the sexual ones, but if you were to bring them together, what we have observed is that the sexual reproduction individuals are being actually driven away by the asexually reproducing individuals. This is to say that if you were to look at it from a quote-unquote group selection argument, you get one result. If you were to mix them together, you get completely different result. And again, one of the interesting point about this particular model that we are working with was the concept that we now can integrate in an evolutionary model, theoretically oriented evolutionary model, not only a genotype and relation between this genotype to a fitness value, but we were able to relate, to incorporate a developmental stage. And once you incorporate a developmental stage to the evolutionary process, a lot of what we have learned from population dynamics, etc., a lot of the intuition we gain is being washed away. So this is yet another important aspect of systems biology or computational biology. It provides us with tools that give us completely different insight, if that insight than that we gained by looking at it from a by far more simplistic way. Mm-hmm. It gives us, it enables us to analyze and to come to conclusions that we were not being able to gain earlier with looking at the models from a much more simplistic way.
There are a lot of costs and benefits involved here, obviously, in the sense that traditionally my understanding is that one of the advantages of sexual reproduction is that you are then having providing a genome which has more capacity to respond to changing environmental selective pressures.
This is only but one element. There is one theory that says that evolution of sexual reproduction is such that it generates more diversity, more variation in the population. But nobody has demonstrated that this actual increase in variation is indeed can address the twofold cost. So in order to, for evolution to, or for any model to demonstrate that indeed sexual reproduction is something which is beneficial to you, you have to overcome this twofold cost paradox. But again, going back to the idea of unavoidability, maybe this is an accident in evolution that we ended up with a sexual reproduction, and it doesn't mean that it is not going to be there forever or it is not going to be maintained, but it may not be the most optimal way of progressing or transmitting our genes from generation to generation. But as I said, evolution is not, it should not be equated with progress.
I'm just thinking, I was smiling there, I was thinking of a line of Lewis Thomas's where he said, the capacity to blunder slightly is the real miracle of DNA. Without the special attribute, we would still be anaerobic bacteria and there would be no music. It occurred to me that if we were asexually reproducing species, it severely put a crimp in the number of romance novels and movies, it seems to me. But they would be different. How did you get into this? Why this particular interest? How did you, were you, come from a background of science? Did you always plan to be a scientist?
Oh, this is an interesting question. No, I come from a background, I always was interested in science. I studied physics earlier, and then when I moved to the United States, I started to be more interested in biology. And the link between physics and biology made me, naturally drove me to this area of systems biology. We have been doing that practically for many, many decades, way before the current era of systems biology have begun. Historically, it's an accident. I can give you a beautiful post-mortem story as why am I doing what am I doing now, but at the end of the day, it is simply turns that I took that were driven mainly by my interest, and I was really very, very privileged to be able to pursue those type of interests. And I never think about what might be the next project. I'm naturally led to that project, and I'm a very strong believer in randomness.
This is a subject, of course, that's intimately interwoven with people's everyday lives, experiences. I mean, life and death. I mean, by definition. In the discussions where Tuck Finch was talking as well about looking at the impacts of global trends in global warming, in infectious diseases, and so on and so forth. I mean, do you think about this when you're at the bench? Do you think about the larger implications of this work?
You must think about those larger implications. I'm a theoretician, so I'm hardly work at the bench. But I do not try to encompass all of those parameters into the models, into the ideas that I'm working on. But at the back of my mind, it is not out of the question that at some point some of them will be incorporated. I was doing population genetics for a few years, where the genome was represented as a bit string, and the fitness of an individual was a simple matrix that translated this bit string into a number. Few years later, I made that model a little bit more complex. And the more we complexifying the system, the closer we get to the reality. However, I cannot make the huge step in and incorporating everything into that single model. I would like to gain better and better intuition. And believe me, I'm sure that the next complexification that I will put to the model will wash away what it is that I've known today. So this is something that we really have to make sure that we are comfortable with, namely that whenever we complexify the model, whenever we bring it to a better and better, closer and closer to reality, we probably are going to gain different intuitions about what it is that we are artificially constructing. So I am thinking about those issues. However, it is impossible at the moment, at least in my simple-minded way of looking at the problem, to incorporate those topics. From a social point of view, it's hard. I'm not a social activist. On one hand, on the other hand, I would like to contribute to society. So, as a scientist, I think we have enormous amount of obligation and enormous amount of responsibility, not only to inform but to be engaged in research that we think are not going to harm the next door neighbor. And aging is a wonderful area of study in which we are trying not only to prolong lifespan, but mainly to prolong healthy lifespan, to create healthy lifespan, so we will age gracefully. And going back to my research, now we have a population of centenarians that we study their genome, and we are trying to link between what might be the differences between those who reach centenarianhood, so to speak, versus us mortal who will never reach centenarianhood. And we have a very large project which is supported by the National Institute of Health to actually study what makes those centenarians centenarians.
So one of the things, perhaps one of the best things to come out of a workshop like this is the connections you make with other people, the collaborations that might emerge from it. And so.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this workshop introduced me to some new players in the field, and the cast of characters that I'm going to be interacting with now, I think, has been quote-unquote enlarged. Now I have a better theater to work with.
Aviv Bergman, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.